the fragile environment that humans and wildlife depend on to survive. Earth Day provides this opportunity for positive actions and results. Earth Day is, in fact, a powerful catalyst for change. If you understand the issues relating to eating lower on the food chain and are already a vegan, vegetarian, or vegetarian, you will have come a long way in lowering your ecological footprint every day of the year and also saving animals from being tortured in cruel factory farm situations. You are listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, known as Co-op Radio, your commercial-free, community-based and community-sponsored radio station. Alan Jensen is in the control room. My name is Carl Loskin, and in the studio today, we have John Pranger, who will be taking your phone calls, and we'll be hearing from Alan Jensen shortly why this is such an important time of the year. We only do it twice a year, call for people to phone in, and John Pranger will be there. Co-host Marge Adams will be back with us next week. Shortly, we'll be speaking with Christiane Wilhelmsen, who is the Clean Air and Water Program Coordinator for the Strait of Georgia, the Georgia Strait Alliance. At the half-hour mark, we will contact Madalena Bearzi, who is the President and Co-Founder of the Ocean Conservation Society based in California. She is the author of a newly published book called Beautiful Minds, and we will discuss the parallel lives of great apes and dolphins. And over to Alan. Alan, the message today is John Pranger is waiting for phone calls.
Yes, and actually Alex from the next program, EcoShock, is already here as well to help out on the phones. So you don't need to worry about there not being somebody here to speak to you if you call in at 684-8494. Area code 604-684-8494. And then you can just tell them, yeah, I'd like to join Co-op Radio. And whatever you can afford to give to Co-op Radio, from $25 to $2,500, whatever you can do. It's a regular membership is $50 a year, and then you can take out other types of memberships, but just give whatever you can. It's all tax deductible. You can get a tax receipt for anything you give, and you can pay by Visa or MasterCard when you phone in, or we will send you a package with a return envelope and you can send your check in. Or you can come down on Sunday. There's an open house here Sunday afternoon. Come in between 1 and 5 on Sunday and see Co-op Radio, meet some of the people and look at the equipment and so on, and you can pay your membership then. Just before we go to our guests, I'll mention that we have some incentives. If you want to become a member during today's show, Carl brought in a couple of great things. There are CDs featuring Jane Goodall and Dana Lyons. And Jane Goodall is a great storyteller. This is a series of stories about chimpanzees by Jane Goodall and punctuated by some songs by Dana Lyons. And it's a great thing. We also have some copies of the Vegetarian Manifesto put together by Earth Save Canada. So if you'd like one of those incentives, just mention it to the people on the phone and you can have one. But the important thing is to support Co-op Radio. It's your listener-sponsored, listener-supported, non-profit, community radio station. Been here for 33 years now and going to stay here for another 33 years, but we need your help to do that. And now, Carl, Christiane is on the phone.
Right. Well, as mentioned before, Christiane Wilhelmsen, she's the Clean Air and Water Program Coordinator for the Georgia Strait Alliance, georgiastrait.org. Welcome to Animal Voices, Christiane.
Thanks for having me on your program.
Yes, and, well, you know, you have quite a bit of news because the Georgia Strait is so much a part of the whole of Vancouver and Vancouver Island. And maybe you can just tell us a little bit about the ecological part that the Georgia Strait plays and your organization, and what's happening there.
Well, as everybody knows, the Georgia Strait is a very unique part of the world. It has a broad one; it's one of the most biodiverse places anywhere, and it is also one of the most at-risk environments because of the activities that happen on it, under it, and around it. And for us, one of our major concerns is the way we manage our liquid waste or sewage around the strait. As most people probably know who listen, Victoria is certainly probably the worst offender when it comes to not treating their sewage at all. They dump it untreated into the Strait of Juan de Fuca every day, and of course some of that ends up coming into the strait. But over here in Vancouver, though there is some treatment of our sewage, we're not treating it to the highest levels possible in order to protect the Strait of Georgia and its adjoining waters. Over 50% of the sewage that's produced in Greater Vancouver is dumped into the strait and into Broadland Inlet at only what we call primary level of treatment. So about 50% of the toxins have been taken out and about 50% of the organic matter has been taken out, but all the rest of it is being dumped into our environment. And, you know, we really can't say what the long-term impacts are going to be of the growing number of toxic chemicals we use and that end up going down into our ocean, going down the drain and out into our oceans.
So, but it's not only sewage, Christiane. It's everything that goes down the drain. It's everything. Now, what does that all include?
Oh, I mean, it's everything, because it also includes stormwater. So when you're driving down the road and a little bit of gasoline and oil falls off your car, rain comes and washes it into our storm drain. So that's part of the problem. There are a lot of toxins going into our stormwater. But also in our homes, just think about everything you use that ends up getting washed down your sink, your laundry, your bathtub. So personal care products, soaps and shampoos, laundry soap. Or if you happen to be someone who maybe has dumped a bottle of whatever down the drain, or you're not finishing some pharmaceutical drugs, you dump those down, all that ends up going to our sewage treatment system, and eventually a good percentage of that ends up going into the ocean. In parts of the world, we're starting to have measurable amounts of chemicals, pharmaceuticals in the water, and though we're dumping into a larger body of water in the oceans, that the effects are eventually going to really show themselves. I mean, we know that the animals that make their home in the straits, some of them have toxins in their body that we can measure. So the impact is definitely there. But, I mean, we can do a lot by not putting these things down the drain. I mean, it's much easier if these chemicals aren't put down before they end up going to a sewage treatment plant. But we still need to treat our sewage at the highest level. And in Vancouver, we're not. And we don't plan to do it for far too long as far as we're concerned.
Now, maybe you can just go into some detail. I know you covered it a little bit, but a little bit more detail, please, about what the primary process really means, and at which points is it going into Georgia Strait in the Vancouver area?
Primary treatment essentially is a kind of a mechanical treatment where it's settling tanks. So whatever floats to the top or sinks to the bottom gets taken out, and then that material, whatever's left, gets dumped out into the strait. At the Iona treatment plant, which is located right in Richmond, right next to the airport, there's a 7-kilometer pipe that takes this primary treated sewage or effluent straight out into the Strait of Georgia. Over on Lions Gate, which is also a primary treatment plant, it's right under the Lions Gate Bridge, just in West Vancouver, that pipe goes into Burrard Inlet with primary treated sewage. So that pipe is, you know, heading out at Ambleside Beach, or if you're at the Capilano River, you know, you're probably staring in the direction of the pipe.
So now I imagine these big tanks, and they're turning around and they're adding chlorine. And just correct me if I had this wrong here. So
yeah, they actually don't use chlorine at the treatment plants here. But you're right, they're big. The current systems are big settling tanks and so on. Yeah.
So settling tanks, but they only take out. So what they sort of get mushed up. So all the stools and everything that goes in there gets mushed up, like into a liquid.
Mm-hmm. Because when you think about all the water, like when you're flushing, so what gets to the sewage treatment plant is very liquidy. It's actually sewage when it gets to a treatment plant is like 98% water, but that doesn't mean it's not harmful. It contains a lot of harmful things in it. And then they settle out the tanks and remove oils and greases, and anything heavy that falls to the bottom gets removed.
So that's what we call
primary
process.
Treatment,
because
yeah.
We're going to go into this primary and secondary.
Secondary, what they do is exactly what they do in primary, but then they add a biological process, which is essentially small organisms that further break down the organic matter. And in that, secondary treatment can remove, for example, 99% of PCBs can be removed through that process, 90% of some of the toxic chemicals like endocrine disrupting chemicals can be removed. I mean, if you go to tertiary treatment, then you add another layer on top of that. So you do primary, secondary, and then you add tertiary, and that can be things like reverse osmosis and all sorts of other layers, which can remove almost all of the contaminants from sewage streams.
Now, what we have is primary, and basically, please correct me if I have it wrong, this is settling tanks, and then 50% of all the fecal matter from, say, in from all of Vancouver and all of the North Shore gets settled down. The stools get broken up. They take out, presumably, all the papers. That's part of the solid. Does it sink to the bottom, the paper? And then the rest just goes into the ocean, goes under the jaw. But why does the water always look clean?
Well, I mean, when you think about that, it's pretty liquidy to begin with, and then it goes out into a marine environment. So there, it's true that there's a certain level of dilution. So, you know, that's why we don't see it. But the problem is the fact that all the things that we don't see are actually harming us. I mean, it is very likely that some of the organics and the fecal matter end up rising to the surface on some days, depending on the currents. I mean, that certainly happens in Victoria. And so our concern is more with, I mean, there is evidence right around the outfall and north of the outfall, because at Iona, the currents bring what is coming out northward. And there's evidence of contaminants there, and there's evidence of fecal matter on the bottom. The Metro Vancouver doesn't seem to be too concerned with that as far as impacts. But that's an indication of us that it doesn't just go away. There's no such thing as away. This stuff is ending up going down to the Strait of Juan de Fuca, up through Georgia Strait. But, hopefully our concern and our demand really is that these treatment plants be upgraded now, that we not be waiting more decades.
So our wonderful wild salmon are living in a cesspool of sewage and excrement, mm-hmm. and as a result of the primary process. Alan has a question.
Sure.
Oh, I just had a point to make in terms of the Iona sewage plant. I go out there bird watching sometimes. You can walk to the end of the jetty, right? So that's 4 kilometers of that 7 kilometer pipe you were talking about. And anybody can go there and walk. And it's a lovely place to walk out. It's nice. You can look back and see the North Shore Mountains. And then there's always lots of nice birds around there. But when you get to the end of the jetty, you can look out another 3 kilometers to where the pipe ends and the effluent is coming up to the surface. And you can't see the effluent, but you can see thousands of birds out there, like thousands and thousands of seagulls and other birds around out there where this stuff is coming up to the surface. And I suppose it's partly the effluent and partly the fact that the effluent attracts, small fish or other creatures, and then, so you end
fat
up...
fat grease in there as well, probably floating to a little bit, not too much. But yeah, the birds are out there, and that's what they're feeding on, and then they come to land and...
Yeah, right. And so clearly this is not good for these birds, because it's not just nice, clean sewage that they're getting out there.
Not at all, which is why it's really important that these systems be upgraded right away. I mean, we've been putting it off for far too long. We've not taken responsibility for our waste. I mean, and to be honest, the thing with sewage is, and it's probably a new idea for a lot of people, but sewage is actually a resource. We could be processing our sewage and getting heat out of it, biofuels, water. And we could actually be having the sewage give back to the community rather than us dumping it into the ocean and hoping the environment takes care of it.
What are the regulations as regards putting this toxic sludge on farmland?
There are regulations as far as biosolids. To my knowledge, that is not done in British Columbia. They are using the biosolids for remediation of mines and so on, but I do not believe that they do that in this province.
I believe that legislation exists that they are able to do that, recently passed by this government in Victoria.
I was not aware of that, and I think that we should be very concerned with that, because I think you'd have to do an extensive amount of analysis of the biosolids, the sludge, before you put it on agricultural land. That just simply would not be something.
I just wanted to ask, it looks like finally something is going to happen about Victoria. I mean, for years and years we've been hearing about the totally gross situation in Victoria, where this large city is just dumping its rotten, totally untreated sewage. But I gather there's something in the works, so to speak.
They've been mandated to treat their sewage, and they're planning for it, so it's going to happen.
Is it going to be primary, though?
It has to be secondary. Just so your listeners know that the federal government is finally coming up with laws that will mandate secondary sewage treatment in all communities across the country, doesn't matter where you live, your sewage will be treated to the secondary level. These laws will come into place, as far as we know, in 2010. So Victoria will have to have secondary sewage in the subsequent years. There's timelines associated with these new laws. And the same thing for Vancouver. And as far as we're concerned, the absolute outset for Iona and Lionsgate to be updated, as far as these laws are, or our interpretation of these new laws, is 2020, which means that Iona will be upgraded as it was planned to be, and Lionsgate will be upgraded 10 years earlier. However, that's still 12 years away. And a secondary sewage treatment system can be built in 6, 7, 8 years approximately. So, you know, if we decide that this is important, we can start building this very shortly and have sewage treatment far before 2020.
Now, you're here with a mission, Christiane Willemsen. I'd like to remind people, maybe you can give us your web page. It's easy to remember.
If you want information on what's happening around the sewage treatment issue, our website is www.georgiastrait.org, and that's S-T-R-A-I-T. Straight. And what I'd like to tell people as well is that you have the opportunity actually to tell Metro Vancouver what you think about what they should be doing about sewage treatment, because they're consulting with the community right now. Right now there are a few people coming out to the sessions, but we think it's really important that people tell the Metro Vancouver that we want sewage treatment, secondary sewage treatment, or higher level now. If you live in Vancouver, you can go to the consultation session on Wednesday, April 23rd at the Library Square. If you live in North Vancouver, on April 22nd at the Sportsplex at Capilano College, and all that information is on our website.
So let's just go over that for most people who live here in Vancouver. It's going to be at the Library Square, Alice McKay Room, on April the 23rd. And in North Vancouver, April the 22nd, at the Capilano College Sportsplex. Right. So So this has been arranged by the feds. Now, I'm really curious about the disparity in the regulations with 2010 and 2020. And I was sort of, discouraged to hear you say it takes 7 years till this gets implemented. And we were hoping that at least we would stop having the salmon off Capilano River swimming in a cesspool of sewage end before 2010. How long will it take?
It's unfortunate that happened, but we have, unfortunately, the provincial government who approved the plan to delay secondary sewage treatment for decades to blame for this. I mean, if in 2002 they had mandated secondary treatment, we could have had at least one of those plants, if not both, upgraded by 2010. Now that's simply an impossibility, and it's unfortunate. The region is being forced into it by the new federal laws, and it's just unfortunate that we don't take more responsibility for it. We were encouraging people to tell them that 2020 is still a long ways away, and we could be doing this faster, because we really need to stop the pollution of the Strait of Georgia and the region, because it's something we can stop. I mean, there's lots of pollution sources in our environment that are hard to regulate. Sewage isn't, and especially when you have the opportunity to, you know, have it cost less in the long run when you can get resources from it. And we think that's actually an opportunity for the community. It shouldn't be looked upon as a negative thing that's going to cost us. It's actually something that can give back to us.
Now, you're the only citizens group focusing on protecting the marine environment in and around the Strait of Georgia. Thank you for doing what you are. And I hope people will come out to the meetings, going to your webpage, georgiastrait.org, Strait spelled S-T-R-A-I-T. So just like to cap up in closing here some of the wonderful information you've given us now.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Well, anyway, just a closing note here.
Yeah, I think I'll just reemphasize what you said, that I hope people do come out. I know that liquid waste and sewage is not the sexiest issue out there, but it's actually an important one, and we really need to tell our regional government that we want an innovative approach to how we manage our sewage, that it be transparent and the community really be involved, and you have that chance to have your voice heard. I mean, we don't always have that choice in our community, and I hope people will take advantage of it because they can have a part in protecting this region.
Thank you, Christiane Willemsen, for being a wonderful spokesperson for clean water and clean air in the Georgia Strait.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
And over to Alan Jensen, and maybe we have a little bit of music. I'd like to remind people that shortly we'll be having Biazzi. Madalena,
and that sounds like a very interesting topic she's going to be talking about, relating dolphins and great apes, and I think that sounds very interesting. So, we'll see what happens with time. I might play some music, but first of all, I want to thank Leah, who called in to join Co-op Radio and support Animal Voices, and this is great, and hopefully you can join Leah and all the people who have called in during this year's fundraising drive. There's only a couple of days left in this year's fundraising drive for Co-op Radio, and we need you to join us. We still have a ways to go to reach the goal that was set for this drive, and we need to reach the goal. The Co-op Radio needs the money. Co-op Radio does not get money from big businesses or big governments. It gets money from you, the listener, from people in the community who realize how important it is to have an alternative voice, to have a radio station that brings you the type of programming you hear here that you don't get anywhere else. And it's not, you don't get this sort of information in any medium by and large, and it's especially important to have a radio station that people all over Greater Vancouver can hear. Also, well, our transmitter carries not only Greater Vancouver, but over to the island and down to Washington State, northern Washington State, but also we're heard on cable throughout British Columbia. Also, we're heard on the Internet. So lots of people can hear this information, and it's very important that we get it out. And I say information, but also we have all sorts of wonderful music programs and arts programs and other types of programming. But the first thing you need to do is join us, and the first thing you need to do is go to your phone and dial area code 604-684-8494. The only way Co-op Radio can stay here for another 33 years is if you join us and join Co-op Radio. Carl is a volunteer. I'm a volunteer. All the people who hear here are volunteers. There is a skeleton staff, and I emphasize skeleton. These poor people. Well, they're paid enough to keep them going, but they're really overworked because there should be more than there are four basically part-time people who do the administration here, and there's several hundred volunteers. I kid you not. There's hundreds of volunteers who come down here, work on the programs, do all the behind-the-scenes work and help in the office and do all kinds of things. And that's something you can do if you want to get involved in the station when you become a member. But the important thing to do is join all those volunteers and all the programmers, all the people who are here, and all the many, many other people who have called in during this. There's hundreds of people who have called in already during this year's fundraising drive. I'm not sure how many, but 300-400 people, more than that, hundreds of people. And join them. Join us. Keep Co-op Radio on the air. Co-op Radio is a non-profit, listener-owned station. You wonder who owns these things. Who owns the newspapers, the radio, TV? Well, most of those things are owned now by multinational corporations, giant corporations. Co-op Radio is owned by the people who support it. That is, by you if you become a member. Nobody else. You get one share in Co-op Radio when you become a member, and you can't have more than one share. You can't play the media magnate and start gathering shares together and get control. You can only have one share, I'm afraid, but you will get one share, and you'll be a part owner of a radio station when you support Co-op Radio. And that's part of the democratic approach Co-op Radio has. And the members, the owners of the station, can meet once a year at the annual general meeting, vote for a board of directors, and so on. You can take part in the station, do the degree you want to. But the main thing you need to do at this point in time, this is the time of year when we take a few minutes out now and then during our programming to remind you that this is how it works. How does a radio station work that is non-profit, that is able to say whatever it wants, that the programmers can talk about controversial issues without worrying about offending advertisers or offending the government or offending anybody else? Not that we want to offend anybody necessarily, but we want to tell the truth, and sometimes talking in a critical way about what's going on in the world does ruffle some feathers because some people are doing things they shouldn't be doing, and so on. Support Co-op Radio, 684-8494, and I'm just going to play a little promotional announcement for a program that's coming up in a couple of days, and then we'll be back with the next part of today's show.
By sleeping, Stark Raven, Monday, April 21st, 7 p.m., Stark Raven takes you for a rock and roll tour of jailhouse musicians. Find out the details at prisonjustice.ca. And tune in Monday, April 21st, 7 p.m. for this Stark Raven CFRO special, Rockin' from the Inside.
One of the many special programs coming to you as part of this year's fundraising drive. Tune in tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock for Red Eye. Saturday morning at Red Eye, they'll be doing a special program. Sunday morning, the All Over the Map World Music is doing a special program starting at 10 this Sunday, 10 a.m. And there's just going to be one good program after another. And coming up right after our show today, in fact, at 1 o'clock today, is going to be Addicted to Oil, Radio EcoShock special program, Addicted to Oil, coming up in about half an hour here. But we now have Magdalena Barsai on the phone, and so I'm going to pass it over to Carl.
Yes. Thank you, Alan, for you always speak so well. And yes, you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. And many of our programs are posted on our webpage, animalvoices.org. Magdalena Barsai is the president and co-founder of the Ocean Conservation Society based in California, and she is the author of a recently published book called Beautiful Minds, Exploring the Parallel Lives of Great Apes and Dolphins, Two Widely Divergent Groups. Welcome to Animal Voices, Magdalena Barsai.
Hello, Carl, and thanks for having me.
That's great. Well, anyway, I just said that there are two widely different groups, apes and dolphins. So why did you choose that for the title, for your subject of your book, Beautiful Minds?
I study dolphins for many years, and my co-author, Craig Stanford, studied great apes for many years. And we met a few years ago when I was doing research in the bay, Santa Monica Bay here in California. And we started talking about this animal, and more we were talking, and more we found similarities and parallels. These animals are both large brain, intelligent mammals. They both have complex society, complex communication, complex social interaction. So we decided to write a book about all these parallels.
So is it in, is the book about the evolutionary path, and do you refer anything to humans?
Yes, the book starts talking about the fascination that humans have with this animal, then talk about their complexity of their society, how similar they are to us, and we make also correlation with humans as well. We have a lot in common with this animal, a lot more than what many people can think.
So we're able to solve problems, but they do too. Maybe you can just tell us about that.
Yeah, in their own environment, dolphins and great apes solve problems in different ways. These environments are very complex. So dolphins, for instance, have to find the food that is partially distributed in the ocean, so they have to have developed a specific technique to do that. Great apes do the same to find partially distributed fruit, for instance, in the forest. They both have this complex society. They have alliances, both of them, in a way that we humans have alliances as well. They can be very territorial. They can have aggression. They both have a strong care for their young as well.
Now, is there a relationship between the weight of the body and the weight of the brain? But maybe compare the different species, including the humans?
Yes, if we look at the brain of dolphins, human, and great apes, the weight of a human brain is about 1,000 kilos. A great ape is about 350 grams. And dolphins are 25% more of a human brain. But if we look at what scientists call encephalization quotient, is the relationship between brain and body size, dolphins are even closer to human than great apes are. And that's kind of interesting.
Now, how do you explain this a relationship between dolphins and humans in that we hear of incidences where dolphins save human lives? Is this true? And what do you make of it?
Yeah, I'm sure that in a certain case it's true. We have many stories about this. We don't really have scientific data, but it's true we have many stories. And dolphins seems to be very altruistic animals. They help other dolphins when they are in distress. So it doesn't seem so absurd to think they can't help human life as well.
So you studied the dolphins, and of course your co-author studied the apes, but you were mostly involved in California, and you wrote your book Beautiful Minds, which we would love people to go and have a look at your webpage, of course, and maybe you could just mention your webpage, start off with.
Yeah, sure. Our webpage is Ocean Conservation Society, www.oceanconservation.org.
Now, you said the societies of the dolphins are very altruistic. And so maybe you can tell us, you've been observing these dolphins for so many years. Maybe can you tell us some of the notable things that you saw there on a personal experience level?
And there are many stories that fascinated me, and I describe some of these stories in the book. Some were important from a scientific point. I studied for many years, for instance, the relationship between dolphins and sea lions in the water. But there is a story that I talk about it in the fascination chapter of this book that maybe is of more interest for your audience. And it happened a few years ago. I was studying bottlenose dolphins along shore here in California. They usually move really close to shore, maximum of 500 meters. So we are going back and forth to study this animal as we do on a regular basis. But suddenly, one of the individual in this group of dolphins move offshore, and the rest of the school follow this dolphin. And we found ourselves about 2.5 miles offshore, and this animal start creating a circle. And that's why when we saw a girl in the middle of the circle, and she was completely dressed, she has an envelope attached to her neck with some documents inside. She was completely cyanotic, and she was asking for help. So we took her aboard, and we immediately returned to land, and we took her to a hospital. The doctor told us that the girl would die in minutes if we didn't save her, and she was committing suicide. She was really young. That's when came to my mind how we found her, and thanks to the dolphins. And I'm usually pretty skeptical as a scientist about all this story, but I have to admit that story really touched me closely.
Now, your book is titled Beautiful Minds. Maybe this is part of the beauty, is the love and kindness, or how would you say that?
Yeah, more you study this animal and more you realize how similar they are to us. They can love and hate, and this is true for dolphins as it is for great apes. And more we know about this animal, the more really we realize all the communality with our species as well.
So if they can love and hate, why do we treat them so badly? Why do we fish them? Why do we eat them? This is, and ships go out and slaughter them in Japan. We know this. We've had that on our show so many times.
Yeah, this is a really good question. These animals are so close to us, so beautiful, why we treat them that way. I don't really have an answer for that. I hope we can have more respect for our environment, both the ocean environment and the forest, because if we don't do something about this animal, we will lose these beautiful minds.
That's right. So we're potentially looking here at extinct species. We'll be covering a bit later about the exploits of Paul Watson, the Sea Shepherders organization, going down to Antarctica. And, of course, it's not only dolphins, but it's all the cetaceans, isn't it?
Yes, it's true. All the species are all either threatened or in danger or critical in danger. This is true both for dolphins and great apes.
Now, Madalena, I hope you don't mind, but I'd just like to go back on another subject that you've covered but is of great fascination to me, is this whole evolution of the species and how the, when we look at maybe thousands of years, I always imagine the human species, you know, used to sort of more or less walk on all fours and then became more upright. And what happened to the apes and dolphins? They, what happened to them? They've evolved, but maybe just go into a little bit more detail. I'm kind of fascinated with that.
Yes, we all have a long time to evolve. I guess what differences from great apes and dolphins is the tremendously rapid enlargement in our brain size over a relatively short time period. So this really made the difference between us and the dolphins, because if we look at the past and we'll look at the level of encephalization of Homo erectus, that was the direct precursor for Homo sapiens, that is us, was not much greater than that of a Tucuxic. There was a small coastal river dolphin found in the murky waters of the Amazon basin. So if we look at the past, really long time ago, the brain, the level of encephalization of a man was even smaller than one of a dolphin. But then, during the evolution and with the passing time, we have this really fast enlargement in our brain size, and that's what really put us as aside from these animals.
Well, you certainly seem to have a wonderful book here with all the information you've given our readers today, and it's a kind message because your title of your book is Beautiful Minds, and if you could give us your, in closing, if you could give us your web page, we hope that many people will go and have a look at it.
Yes, I hope many people will read this book and they can understand how magnificent these species are. They can find more information on the book on the Harvard Press website and also on our website at www.oceanconservation.org.
Oceanconservation.org. Thank you, Madalena Biarzi, for being on Animal Voices.
Thank you.
Bye for now.
Bye.
Yes, and over to Alan Jensen, and we hope to be covering in some detail the issues of what's been happening on Newfoundland and the seal slaughter. Let's make sure this is a seal slaughter. It's not a hunt. In a hunt, the animals have a reasonable chance to get away. And we have some... Over to you, Alan. What have you got up for us?
Well, I agree. It's a joke to call it a hunt by any standards. It is a slaughter.
It's a joke to call it a... Yes, that's right. It's a joke to call it a hunt.
Yeah, it's... though I just wanted to mention, I can see through the monitor here that's from the camera out in the hall that the people in the phone room, they just... hung up the phone up there, so there is an open liner to phone line or two if you would like to call into Co-op Radio to support Co-op Radio and to support this program on this year's fundraising drive. Animal Voices has been with you for, how many years has the show been on the air now?
9 years. We've been going 9 years.
Holy smokes. And a lot of great programs, a lot of important information has come out in this program over those years. It's really a valuable show and very worth having on the air. But it's one of about, 85 different programs on every week on Co-op Radio, many of which are very valuable shows and dealing with different topics, different subjects. Some of them are music shows. After today's show, you're going to hear Radio EcoShock, which looks at environmental issues in a more general way, whereas this program looks at animal issues. That's going to be followed by the Community Living Show, done by people from the Community Living community here in Vancouver, and that's going to be followed by the A-Train, a great jazz program that's been around here even longer than Animal Voices has been on the air. And the programs just carry on, a good variety, a good mix of programs. This is a very eclectic radio station, has all kinds of programming for all kinds of people. You can just listen to it all day and you won't get bored, but if you have specific interests like animals or like jazz or like whatever, you can tune in and check out those programs when they're happening. And when you become a member of Co-op Radio, you'll get a listener's guide mailed to you so you can see when the programs are on. Of course, you can go to the internet and go coopradio.org and check out the program guide there. But what we're asking you to do today is call 684-8494 and support Co-op Radio. We do have a copy left of the CD featuring Jane Goodall and Dana Lyons. And like I said earlier, Jane Goodall is a great storyteller, and you'll be happy you got this if you get one. Also, we have a couple of copies of The Vegetarian Manifesto, a book by Earth Save Canada. So if you'd like to have one of those, you can just call up and take out a membership at any membership level, and as an incentive, you can have one of those. But the incentive you really get, the thing you really get from when you join Co-op Radio, is knowing that you're supporting a community radio station that it really deserves your support and needs your support. We need you to join us, join Co-op Radio, become a member. It's tax-deductible membership. You can do it very easily. Just call up and we can take your Visa, MasterCard, and deal with it right then and there.
So do we have some music by Dana Lyons? Just a little break there. One of the stories?
I don't have it queued up, I'm afraid. I do have some other music, some local music queued up, because I wasn't sure if we're going to be needing any music. Well, I'm going to play a couple of seconds of music. This is a transition here, and we'll be back in just a second. It's a little John Reichman. We're going to play a cut of this CD featuring Jane Goodall and Dana Lyons. We're going to play one of the short stories. They're actually like memoirs. They're not fictional stories. They're anecdotes, so to speak, by Jane Goodall. Just because they're so nice. This one is called Satan and Sprout.
This is the story of Satan and Sprout. One day I was following Satan through the forest, 23 years old, a young male in his prime. He got his name when he was just a kid. He actually stole a manuscript that my mother was writing, and we had to bribe him with a banana to get the chewed remains back again. But that was long ago. And now he's traveling alone, and suddenly he hears ahead of him the sounds of an excited group of chimpanzees feeding clearly on something delicious. Imagine this with 20 chimpanzees all making the same excited cries. Satan's hair bristles with excitement, and he hastens along the trail and soon comes to a big tree. There's a lot of fruit up there and many chimpanzees feeding. And he swings up the trunk, and he aims for a large bunch of ripe red fruit. There's a younger male feeding there already, but that's okay because Satan is dominant to him. So he approaches and he makes a arm threat gesture. The young male screams and backs away, and Satan begins to feed. But what Satan didn't realize is that young male's older brother is feeding higher up in the tree. And hearing his kid brother scream, he comes swinging down, and now the two brothers start attacking Satan, and Satan screams. To my amazement, a very ancient female who was peacefully feeding way up in the canopy starts swinging down, and she hurls her frail self onto these three battling males, each of whom weighs at least twice as much as she. And with her puny little fist, she begins hitting at the two brothers, who I think are so surprised that they mildly threaten her, and Satan gets away. That was Satan's ancient mother, Sprout, probably at least 50 years old, hair thin, teeth worn down to the gums, but still running to the defense of her great big bully son.
And that was Jane Goodall from the CD entitled Circle the World with Jane Goodall and Dana Lyons. Wonderful stuff. It is now 12:50.
And if you'd like to have a copy of that, we're giving away for people who phone in these Jane Goodall stories, which we just heard one of them now.
Yeah.
And we also did that to complement Madalena Biarazzi's book about dolphins and apes. So that's why we played that now. So anyway, thank you, Alan, always for putting that on. You know, one of the wonderful organizations that I support and that has been a great inspiration for me has been Earth Save Canada. And Earth Save Canada, earthsave.ca, they put out a weekly newsletter. And one of the items that caught my eye was there was a prize winner for virtual water. I never heard of virtual water before. This pioneer, he wins the Stockholm Water Prize, which is considered the Nobel Prize of Environmental Science. Alan was awarded the prize for introducing the concept of, as I said, virtual water, which provides a way of calculating the amount of water needed to produce anything from coffee to hamburgers. People use water in many ways that they do not even notice. Behind that morning cup of coffee are 140 liters of water used to grow, produce, package, and transport the beans. So anyway, it's part of the Earth Safe agenda to teach people about the health, environmental, and ethical consequences of our food choices. EarthSave.ca. EarthSave.ca. Well, you know, Alan, I know you're always interested in the bird issues, but also the Farley mowat has been on the issue today in the last week, and of course the seal slaughter. What did you make of that, Alan?
Well, it is a slaughter, and it's just outrageous that this happens. Like, everybody in the world, because Canada's shame, right? Like, everybody in the world knows the Canadian government supports this, not only permits it, but supports it and dumps a lot of taxpayers' money into this by sending out the Coast Guard to protect, in quotation marks, the sealers from the demonstrators. And it costs Canada money. It doesn't make money for Canada. It costs them money to have these hundreds of people who, you know, these are poor people from Newfoundland and other parts of eastern Canada who make a few hundred dollars. Like, there are companies that make a lot of money from selling these pelts, but the people who go out and slaughter the seals aren't making a lot of money. They're just poor people who don't realize exactly what they're doing. But it is so outrageous. There was the boat, of course, that was seized that Greenpeace has is... the Farley Mowat. And actually, there was a great article by Farley Mowat, by the man himself, written in the Globe and Mail the other day, and I don't have time to read it all, but I'm just going to read a very short excerpt. So Farley Mowat went out with the anti-sealing people, with Paul Watson and a bunch of these people, on a boat to see what was happening. And he'd never, Farley Mowat had never actually been out himself to see what was going on. And he writes, "I was appalled. These sealers weren't like fishermen. They were like butchers. A real fisherman takes what he needs to survive. These people were taking a good deal more. Their sole objective was money. And they didn't care much if the seals were killed or not. They'd hit them over the head, cut off their flippers, and skin them alive. The authorities say this is a canard, but that it doesn't happen that way. But it does. It does happen that way. It's the absolute truth." And so, like Farley Mowat was saying, like, he was out there witnessing these seals being skinned alive, and it does happen. And yet the government will try and tell you it doesn't happen, and the people who run the industry will try and tell you that. But it's very interesting. So Farley Mowat goes on to say, "This experience turned me around completely. My sympathy went from the sealers to the seals. And it brought me closer to Paul Watson." So at that point, Farley Mowat started to realize the important work that Paul Watson was doing in this particular vis-a-vis the seals. And he goes on to say, "I watched him expand his defense of the others until it took the whole living entity that cloaks the earth. When I wrote," Farley Mowat says, "when I wrote Sea of Slaughter, I was impelled by his work. I'm dedicating my current book, otherwise, to him." Anyway, I won't read any more. This article is from the Globe and Mail, Wednesday, April 16th. You could find it probably in the Globe archives and the Internet if you wanted to find out more about it. But it's a typically very well-written article by Farley Mowat, by the guy himself. And he's such an interesting person that has done so much for animal welfare. And in this case, he's making it crystal clear, because he's been there himself and seen what is going on the ice floes, crystal clear what this seal slaughter is all about. And it just never ceases to amaze me that the government of Canada not only permits but supports this. And then, you know, of course, the premier of Newfoundland, and of course we have this fisheries minister now, Loyola Hearn, who is from Newfoundland. And so the government, like Stephen Harper, has appointed this guy as fisheries minister, who of course is a champion of the seal hunt. And it's quite incredible.
Well, it's the minister of fisheries, Loyola Hearn. And what did she say about Paul Watson, the people who protest the seal slaughter? She called them... Loyola. Okay. Yeah. Paiola. I thought it was a lady. Anyway, he called them a bunch of money-sucking manipulators. Well, you know...
right.
She called them that. But, you know, with my Jungian... studies, it shows me people often project what they are onto others. And because she is feeding to the concerns, and it's a political issue here, to the Newfoundlanders whose votes they desperately need.
And actually Watson, though, makes the point that he lived in Newfoundland, Farley Mowat lived in Newfoundland for 7 years himself, right? After living in the Arctic. He lived in the Arctic for many years and wrote about Arctic animals, and he moved to Newfoundland and wrote about Newfoundland animals. And Farley Mowat says, in fact, most people he's ever met in Newfoundland do not support the seal hunt, but it's the business, the corporations that profit from the seal hunt, and the government who wants the votes from some of the small villages, the outports, and so on, and that supports it. But it's the majority of people, even in Newfoundland, realize that this is an outrageous thing that goes on, and they're talking about getting rid of the picks that they use to bash the seals over their heads, but they're avoiding the point. And the point is that they're killing baby animals. And what occurs to me, what would people say if farmers went into a farm field, and started killing baby sheep, started killing little lambs this way, slaughtering them and skinning them alive? Like, what would people say? Or baby cows, or calves, or any baby animal, right? But somehow, as it seals, you know, it's somehow acceptable, they're mammals. That was the difference between a dog and a seal, right? They both bark, they both have fur, but somehow the government, the people who run the show, don't perceive that, you know, the dreadful carnage that's going on.
Now the wonderful ship Folly Mote is in custody.
Yeah, yeah, and be like it was in international waters, and it was sealed. Anyway, we're running out of time now, I'm afraid. We have to give time to the next show. It's we only have a minute left.
Well, in this 1 minute, I'd like to remind people that the Folly Mote was down in the Antarctic and was interfering with the whalers, the Japanese whalers. And they had a target of killing 935 minke whales, but because of the good ship Folly Mote, they were only able to get 551 minke whales. 551 minke whales, too many, too much for my liking. And yes, you're listening to Animal Voices.
And I'm just going to have to remind people once again, we have seconds left and I have to go to the next program. So, which is Radio EcoShock with the special Addicted to Oil. And you don't want to miss that. Don't leave your radio. Stay tuned to this next program. It does dovetail with some of the things we've been talking about in this show. Anyway, 684-8494 is the phone number to support Co-op Radio. It's really important you do. We are the voice of the seals here. We're not the voice of the big corporations. So we try and give them a voice. This is Animal Voices. Some of the animals aren't good at speaking for themselves, so we try and speak for them. 684-8494.
Thank you for your support, and thank you for listening.
And we will go now to, it is 1 o'clock, and you are tuned to CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM, listener-sponsored radio in Western Canada.